Hello everyone, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, World Radio Magazine, the online version, for June 2010. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. And for you folks that listen along month after month, there is some additional information and ways to contact Pat Tice, the director, and the secretary in the office, Nancy. Pat's telephone number can be reached at area 763-520-0511. For Nancy, it's 763-520-0512. They're located now at Camp Courage of the Handy Ham System at 8046 83rd Street Northwest, Maple Lake, Minnesota, 55358. That's 8046 83rd Street Northwest, Maple Lake, Minnesota. But if you just want to be comfortable with the old address, that's perfectly all right. They will get the information or the phone call forwarded to them. So let's begin now with the reading of World Radio Online for June 2010. Here's a bit of information about our nation to the south, Mexico. Special 4B, that's 4 Bravo, prefix authorized for Mexican stations. The Mexican Federal Telecommunications Commission has authorized the use of the special 4 Bravo prefix for Mexican stations during 2010. In commemoration of the bicentennial of Mexico's independence and centennial of the Mexican Revolution. AMSAT Space Symposium headed to Chicago. The 2010 AMSAT Space Symposium will be held in Chicago on the weekend of October 8 through 10, event officials said. The agenda includes amateur satellite presentations, operating techniques, news, and plans from the amateur satellite world, a board of directors meeting open to AMSAT members, an opportunity to meet board members and officers, annual general membership meeting, and a banquet with a keynote speaker and door prizes. The symposium will be held at the Elk Grove Holiday Inn near O'Hare Airport. For symposium dates, you can visit the website www.amsat.org/amsat-new/hamvention/2010/dayton.php. I won't even give that one back to you again. That's a little too hard for most folks to work out this early in the morning here. Okay, now another one. Hams in action after Mexico's 7.2 magnitude quake. Radio amateurs in Los Angeles County activated on Easter Sunday after shockwaves from a 7.2 magnitude earthquake in Mexico's Baja California shook the Southern California region just before 4 p.m. Pacific time. Quoting, the Los Angeles section ARIS immediately activated its emergency net with hams from all over the area checking in, close quote. On April 4, according to a report on Amateur Radio Newsline, after hearing no reports of damage in Southern California, soon attention was turned to the south. That's when the net's Spanish-speaking operators were asked to monitor the high-frequency bands for possible traffic from the quake area. According to ARN, Amateur Radio Newsline, Dr. Armando Montalvo, KI6TAA, in the Los Angeles suburb of Woodland Hills, was able to contact Francisco Menses, XC2FMS, in the city of Mexicali, Mexico, along with mobile operators XC2DZZ and XC2BRL. Initial reports said that most stations in and around the quake's epicenter were without electrical power. Also, the major highway between Mexicali and Tijuana suffered severe thrust fault damage. This information was forwarded to the United States Geologic Survey. The report said that, in all, some 36 stations were involved at one time or another during the call-up, but no large-scale ham radio relief effort was needed on either side of the United States-Mexico border. MCOM planners said it was definitely a good test of the ability of the region's hams to respond at a moment's notice. We thank ARN and LAX Ceres. Here's another interesting piece about emergency communications preparedness. Kentucky radio amateurs recycle old TV towers. Bowling Green, Kentucky area radio amateurs want to give new life to old residential TV towers by incorporating them into an emergency communication system, according to a published report. The Kentucky Colonels Amateur Radio Club and the Kentucky 4th District Amateur Radio Emergency Services have been seeking donations of the towers, which have become increasingly obsolete as more households have turned to cable, satellite, and digital TV providers, a story on Amateur Radio Newsline said. In an article in the Bowling Green Daily News, Bill Schlicht, KJ4DGW, of the Kentucky Colonels Amateur Radio Club, said members will move the towers for free, recondition them, and install them at numerous locations in the 10-county Barron River Area Development District. The initiative is to support emergency communications among ham radio operators, hospitals, county emergency management directors, American Red Cross chapters, and other emergency workers. Schlicht said Kentucky Colonels ARC wants to set up at least 16 towers, mainly at area hospitals where ham radio operators can communicate with emergency workers during a large-scale disaster. There are about 400 amateur radio operators in Warren County and the Bowling Green area. It's time now for the editor's log. World Radio Editor is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. Say cheese this month on ARRL Field Day. One item we hope you remember to pack for the 2010 ARRL Field Day on June 26, 27 is a digital camera. Wouldn't it be great to see photos of operating sites from around North America and beyond? We sure think so. By all means, snap some shots of your station setups, antenna, campfire circles, chow tents, or field day teams in action, and send them to us at worldradioonline@gmail.com. We'll periodically publish field day photographs in the pages of World Radio Online magazine and on the World Radio Online blog, which is www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com. Be sure to include a sentence or two describing the action, the call sign of your field day station, and its location. We'll take it from there. Oh, and please be careful while you're operating in the field. We want everybody back home safe and sound with great stories to tell. Join us live, World Radio Online Internet Chat, June the 6th. If you haven't had a chance to join in on one of our live online WRO chats, please mark your calendar for Sunday, June 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's when we'll meet next on the World Radio Online blog. I just gave it at Blogspot. It's www.worldradioonline, all one word for this purpose, .blogspot.com. You'll find a window on the site that will guide you through the chat login. It's really easy. I'll be moderating and it's open to everyone. Here's your chance to chat with me, lots of other WRO readers, and some of our columnists. It's very casual, friendly gab session. The feedback so far has been really positive. Our first session on April 4 lasted about an hour and a half. Great fun. We had about 140 people take part, and more than 200 comments were posted. In addition to the conversation, we invite everyone to sound off in several live online polls. In April, for example, we ask, quoting, "What's your favorite mode?" SSB got 44% of the vote, followed by CW with 35%, Digital with 15%, and AM and FM tied at 3%. We also ask, how do you read WRO each month? A solid 97% said they download the entire magazine, while 3% downloaded in sections. Of the monthly WRO columns, we ask, which one is the most read? Participants rated Kurt Sterba's Aerials column highest with 56%. It was followed by Propagation, Trail Friendly Radio, and Contest Corner, all at 12%. DX World got 6%, and Rules and Regulations got 3%. So now you know. We ask, what's your favorite activity? Almost half of respondents, 48%, said rag chewing, 23% chase DX, and 10% like contesting, 19% listed other. April chat has been replayed by web users more than 400 times. We'll let you know the results of May's poll questions after we've had a chance to crunch the numbers. The live chat conversation is freewheeling, covering everything from current band conditions and operating successes to suggestions from participants about what they'd like to see in upcoming editions of WRO Magazine. You can see a replay of the April 4 and May 2 chats on the World Radio Online blog. We're hosting the chat sessions monthly, so please feel free to stop by. If you'd like an email reminder about upcoming chats, please subscribe to the World Radio-L mailing list at mailman.sunserver.com/mailman/listinfo/World Radio-L. Now, follow WRO on Facebook and Twitter. Just a reminder that World Radio Online is on both Facebook and Twitter. If you haven't gotten on board, we'd certainly like to welcome you. To access WRO's Facebook home, log into www.facebook.com. Then search for World Radio space Online. We have well over 500 followers regularly checking in. To follow us on Twitter, go here. Twitter. twitter.com/WRO magazine. You'll find breaking amateur radio news and links to some fascinating online contact at both sites, updated daily, so we hope to see you there as well. And a final note, meanwhile, please keep in touch by writing World Radio Online at worldradioonline@gmail.com. The editor's log is signed, Richard Fisher, call KI6SN. Well, here comes my first featured selection, Errare Humanum Est, Certainty Exercise from a Roman philosopher's point of view. Commentary, Fra Francesco Gutenberg, call YO4PX. Errare Humanum Est. That aphorism by an ancient Roman philosopher contains an unexpressed thought that man, recognizing his error, can correct it, surpass himself, and approach perfection. Operators of rare DX stations who reside in exotic locations and those who spend time and money on DX expeditions and contest operations firmly allege that in most every case, the much-trumpeted amateur spirit of friendship and international cooperation is forgotten when arises Hamlet's question, to work or not to work a new one. No wonder, say those exasperated amateurs, that many de-expeditioners, bored by the silly hodgepodge produced by certain de-exchasers, prefer to turn their antennas elsewhere to maintain a reasonable QSO rate. No wonder many amateurs residing in rare countries, stuck on believing amateur radio is still a hobby, hide on frequencies less monitored by those certain DXers, or simply go QRT when found and cornered. They go off the air. They probably don't feel obligated to devote their leisure time to making thousands of rubber-stamped QSOs and filling out thousands of QSO cards, because destiny threw them onto one of the rare islands on the DXCC countries list. If someone compiled a classification of the matters on the amateur bands, he would likely be forced to put DXers at the bottom of the list. The jamming champs are everywhere, and we DXers know them. Risking oversimplification, let's examine these DXers. They may occasionally provoke a smile, but too often spoil our fun. The monologuist. This operator prefers the microphone, but can sometimes be found on CW. He is usually equipped with very reliable and up-to-date equipment with which he monitors the bands for his victims. It does not matter too much for him who will be his interlocutors or what they say to him. He has too little patience to listen. The only role others have is to listen to what he says, despite its lack of content. Hopefully, the monologuist has Vox, V-O-X, so when the victim has nearly fallen asleep, he can save himself by shouting, "Break!" and pretend he has to go QRT. After doing this, it is recommended the victim does not show up on the bands for the next few hours in case the monologuist finds him again. The monologuist type of amateur is not generally interested in DX contacts or QSL cards, but still calls DXpeditions and involves them in long QSOs against their will. The illness of the monologuist is a chronic one and has to be regarded rather like a natural calamity, which is beating you without any possibility of self-defense. Now, the next category is the impatient. This operator is under continuous strain. He is driven by an unhealthy curiosity. The impatient posts himself on the DX station's transmitting frequency, despite the operator indicating he is listening up, and then starts to ask questions. He immediately wants to know the DX station's call, his QTH and QSL information, and in the process disturbs everyone trying to work the DX station. With a bit of patience, the impatient could hear the DX station provide this information every 10 or 15 QSOs, and spinning his VFO a bit, he would find where others are calling. In NETS, the impatient ignores NET control's instructions and carries on calling, even though he is not located in the country requested by NET control. He calls regardless of the situation, usually in the middle of your QSO. The best expedient, and one not usually advised by DXing experts, is to give him the information he wants, accept him, let him join the QSO, put him on the list. Otherwise, he may continue to call and cause endless disturbance. The omniscient now. This operator knows he can teach everybody else. If he thinks an operation is failing, he will not hesitate to interfere, nursing and lecturing the ignorant, setting the situation right from his vast store of knowledge and experience. Let's say a novice at working DX rares to ask something on the transmitting frequency of a DX station working split. That is enough for the omniscient. Vigilant and deeply worried about the destiny of the operation, he takes prompt action. He remains on frequency for hours and hours, continuously sending or shouting up to reprimand intruders. His QRM completely covers the DX station, and nobody can tell who the DX station is answering. Despite his well-meaning intentions, one prefers hearing the novice's short questions than the teacher's repeated reprimands. There is no remedy for this helpfulness. Hopefully, he will get bored and move on to another crowded spot on the band. Attempts to silence him only redouble his claims of eminence. Now for my listeners. The author, Francisco Grunberg, Y04PX, goes on to comment about the Avenger, the aggressive, super DX man, the discontented, and the lid. Let's finish up with the lid here. This is the name given to the amateurs whose working methods leave much to be desired. Lids are very numerous and often originate from those amateurs who got their licenses without too much trouble and who did not bother to go through a learning process before getting on the air. The lid never understands what is happening. Tunes up intermittently on the DX station's frequency, not because he wants to disturb anybody, but without first checking the frequency. The lid doesn't listen before calling CQ and gives the impression he doesn't have a receiver because he doesn't hear QSY from the people he QRMs, nor hears the weak DX station on frequency. He calls the DX station on his transmitting frequency, despite the DX station stating he is listening up because the lid doesn't know what up, UP, means. The lid calls the DX station when he comes back to someone else, or even while the DX station is transmitting. The lid answers CQDX calls from non-DX stations because he doesn't know what DX means. On CW, the lid sends much faster than he can read, causing the other stations to send his name and QTH several times because he refuses to request QRS. The lid inadvertently works split, not to keep his frequency clear, but because he doesn't realize his clarifier has to be switched off. The lid will call you when you are calling in a pileup, and worse still, will start the contact without waiting to see if you have come back to him, or he will end up without knowing whether you have logged him or not. He confuses Y-O with Y-A, and Bucharest with Budapest. The lid is able to send CQ 25 times and his call sign only once. The inventiveness of the lid in that he does everything upside down is inconceivable and inexhaustible. Now, to end this enumeration, let's try to discern why there are so many lids on the amateur bands, because we are pretty sure many amateurs branded Avengers or aggressives are actually lids. Is it human nature to make mistakes? Of course, especially when one is not prepared. It begs the question why the novice does not learn about on-air procedures before using his new call sign. After passing the examination, he shouldn't be left to his own devices to find out about procedures on the air. He should be advised that he should initially listen for 90% of the time to avoid finding himself suddenly in the middle of a crowded amateur band, exposing himself to the risk unintentionally of the shame and reputation of a lid. L-I-D. It was different aforetime. Long before getting his transmitter license, the amateur started by being a shortwave listener. For many months, he only listened to the context of other hams, and undoubtedly he enjoyed it, since some amateurs, for some reason, remained SWLs. Let's not forget those listening under dictatorial regimes who would like to become transmitters and aren't allowed to do so. Reception was the best school for learning our written and unwritten laws. Then came the day full of excitement for the first Q-sub made from the club station under the instructor's attentive guidance. Then came other contacts, the first DX stations, the participation in contests. And only when the young amateur accumulated some experience and built his own station would he start to work from home with his own call sign. The internet offers steady and work tools to help get novices on the air while avoiding the epithet lid. They should use them diligently. Knowledge is not innate. Arrere humanus est, persevere diabolicum. To err is human, to persevere is devilish. Well, here's an editor's note. Francesca Grunberg, call Y04PX, can be contacted via email via the call sign Y04 4, that's not the number O, that's the letter O, Y04PX at rdslink.ro. You can visit his website at http://y04px.blogspot.com/. And actually, a version of this article appeared on the British Southgate Amateur Radio Club website at www.southgatearc.org. Hope you enjoyed that rendition. I think it's time to go to a change of pace, look at some promotion and recruitment. The envelope, please. Meet the newest Golden Megaphone winners. The author of this piece is Devere, D-D-E-E, Logan, W-N-H-E-O, Whiskey One, Hotel Echo Oscar. The presentation of the 2009 Golden Megaphone Awards recognizes the promotional accomplishments of several radio clubs. It's an impressive group. Our winners demonstrate the variety of ways in which organizations can transform people's ham radio interest into a desire to become licensed. As we've noted, promotion is a team sport, which is why these awards focus on radio clubs and group activity. An important reason for establishing Golden Megaphone Awards is to recognize effective and innovative promotion and recruitment approaches. The winners also serve as excellent examples for those considering similar programs. Our hope is that the success stories of our winners will also provide motivation for others in the amateur radio community to become activists in spreading the word and encouraging people to join our ranks. Amateur radio's future depends upon steady growth, and that's up to us. In establishing 4 award categories, we enable clubs to select the one that best suits their specific activities. The first category includes the best overall general promotion program, incorporating a variety of communication elements such as media publicity, displays, special events, and flyers. Second is the best individual promotional event. Third recognizes targeted promotions that focus on specific groups such as students or seniors. The fourth covers specific publicity materials such as displays, printed materials, and media announcements, including the internet. Although there are 4 different award categories, all of the 2009 entries were concentrated in 2, a radio club's overall promotional program and promotional activities targeting specific groups. A panel of judges was provided by the Lake Communicators, a Northeast Ohio organization of marketing and public relations professionals. We thank them for volunteering their services. And the winners are, in the first category, winner of the Gold First Place Award for the Best Overall Promotion Program is the New Mexico Amateur Radio Alliance, NMARA, of Albuquerque. This relatively new organization of hams, active in several local clubs, set ambitious goals for introducing the general public to amateur radio. Its objectives included emphasizing the emergency communication role of ham radio, the recruitment of new licensees, and explaining the benefits of allowing amateur radio antennas in residential neighborhoods. One of the most significant and ambitious parts of its promotion program was the creation of a nearly 40-foot-long multimedia display about amateur radio. It was installed in the Albuquerque International Airport and viewed by an estimated 100,000 persons over 6 weeks. Trifold brochures with a "Please Take One" sign were part of the exhibit. Additional publicity events by the New Mexico group included booths, displays, and amateur radio handouts at the Albuquerque Home and Lifestyle Show, the Duke City Hamfest, and Albuquerque Home and Lifestyle Expo. Their presence at these events exposed another 35,000 persons. Overall, this was a very impressive program in the opinion of our judges, who noted the amazing energy and enthusiasm of the group. The remainder of entries concerned Radio Club activities that targeted specific groups, such as students and young people. All of the top three award-winning submissions involved schools, students, and parents. Winner of the Gold's First Place Award for a targeted program was the K4AMG, Memorial Amateur Radio Club of Chesapeake, Virginia. Its main audience was students in the Chesapeake Center for Science and Technology broadcast radio class. Objectives included getting young people involved in amateur radio, assisting with electronic, wireless, and ham radio elmering, which is mentoring, promoting kit building, preparing students for their licenses, and providing radio equipment to newly licensed students. The major activities of the club included assisting the school in forming its own radio club and securing a club license, KJ4PGJ, now the Vanity Call, W4FOS, sponsoring fundraising events for the purchase of 2-meter radios as students pass their tests, and working with the classroom instructor to promote electronics. The club also gave the school a high-frequency station and helped the school participate in the school club roundup. Several communication tools were used by the club. A flyer promoted the radio communications class, and a newsletter to Elmers encouraged their participation in events such as Field Day and the school club roundup. The club supplied a W4FOS banner to the school and helped develop QSL cards for its station. In slightly over 2 years of participation, the club has helped 15 students become licensed, with a potential for a dozen more this year. 6 2-meter radios have been provided to students, along with help in getting on the air. The judges commented that this program had a truly targeted audience and clearly defined objectives, along with a great array of public relations materials. Licensing Washington Kids. Winner of the Silver Second Place Award for its program of conducting licensing classes focused on 9 through 12-year-olds in the Lake Washington Ham Club of Kirkland, Washington. Since 1993, the club has run children's ham radio licensing classes in which both students and their parents participate. The parent is needed to support the child in the purchase of a radio, to provide transportation to the classes, and to join in class activities. The course includes 3 sessions of 3 hours each, with classes limited to short 40-minute lessons with built-in recess time between each lesson. Donuts, juice, and coffee are provided. The course covers enough material to enable a student to earn a ham radio license. The final session includes the exam. Since the classes began, more than 1,000 young, ages 6 through 18 years, have become licensed. The Lake Washington Ham Club also offers 2 kid activity classes during the year, plus a radio fox hunt that concludes with a free hamburger and hot dog barbecue. Wow, what an incentive. The club operates a kids' net Sunday nights on 2 meters and also on the IRLP reflector number 9255. The young radio operators participate in special events such as Field Day and the Arthritis Foundation's Jingle Bells Race as course marshals. Sponsor support has been provided by ICOM America, Alanco USA, Diamond Antennas, M2 Antennas, and the ARRL. Students have written volumes of the ICOM comic series, The Adventures of Jack and Max. Now, regarding targeting physics students, the Bronze Third Place Award for targeted promotion goes to J.R. Tucker High School of Richmond, Virginia. It modified its physics courses from the basic electricity core to include modern electronics, using amateur radio projects in its laboratory curriculum to illustrate basic principles. The primary benefit was providing a head start for students planning careers in engineering, science, or related fields while exposing them to amateur radio. Instructor Richard Castanet, WD4DMZ, is a licensed professional engineer who is introducing creative ways to get his students involved in the learning process. With a grant from Virginia Power, Breadboard electronics sets were purchased that students used to build code practice oscillators during lab time. Next, they built a QRP transmitter, that's low-power transmitter, sending their names over the air. Future radio physics classes will include AM, FM, single sideband, and digital communications and antennas. Using ham radio to demonstrate basic electronics and wireless concepts is expected to interest students in eventually becoming active radio amateurs. And lastly, attracting new members. Honorable mention goes to the Ski Country Amateur Radio Club of Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Its recruiting communication efforts targeted potential club members, including inactive hams and potential new hams. A multimedia campaign was conducted using local press releases and letters to more than 80 licensed amateurs in the region. The key message was an invitation to participate in the club's field day and to attend a future meeting. As a result, the club connected with several inactive members, boosted attendance at its field day site, and produced a new licensed amateur. The author here is D. Veer. D. Logan Call, W1HEO, Whiskey 1, Hotel Echo Oscar. D. is a veteran radio ham and writer who helped establish the Ham Radio Promotion Project, which is www.neoham.org, and may be reached at deverelogan@gmail.com. That's her name, deverelogan@gmail.com. Well, let's see now. You've heard me mention things about field day two or three times already in this last 36 minutes. Now, here's an article in the trail-friendly radio category. Flying solo, operating alone together on ARRL Field Day. The author is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. He happens to be the editor of the magazine, too. Hi, hi. On the countdown to 2010 ARRL Field Day this month, many radio amateurs are scrambling to take part in communal gatherings of radio clubs or friends the weekend of June 26-27, a yearly pilgrimage that's a great time to be part of a team providing the means to a common end. There are lots of operators, though, who see Field Day as an opportunity to be alone together in a solitary trail friendly effort to experience this granddaddy of all operating events. From the wilds of Colorado to the backyard gardens of El Paso, here are observations of some who have operated Field Day alone, experiencing the unparalleled joy and thrill of flying solo. First one here is WG0AT, a singular spiritual experience. For Steve Galcott, WG0AT of Monument, Colorado, solo Field Day operation provides a pure spiritual experience of being miles from nowhere and yet having civilization at your fingertips and the proverbial pileup eager to get your solar-powered signal report in their log. What really does it for me is making contact with another kindred spirit, someone who's also out there in the woods, he said. Galcott is world-renowned for his trail-friendly radio excursions, many documented on YouTube, with his two goats, Rooster and Peanut. They do much of the heavy lifting when toting radio gear to the beautiful and remarkable operating locations WG0AT likes to visit. When Galcott considers solitary field day pursuits, he says sometimes large groups tend to elect leaders, and usually it's someone who likes to lead and enjoys the power trip, and that can be a good or a bad thing. Hopefully it doesn't go to their head and ruin their ability to perform their primary function. Some of this behavior has driven me from clubs and large groups in the past. It's where they spend more time on arguing politics, rules of order, and very little time, if any, on the fun stuff. I realize I may spell fun, F-U-N, differently than some, but the politics and rules just aren't my cup of tea. I guess you could say simpler, in this case, is better and much preferred. It's not about the high-dollar rigs, the big hardware you own or have in the sky, Yalcut said, but it's all about using the gear and antennas you have and becoming skillful with them and having fun with them, kind of like fly fishing. You can spend big bucks on the equipment, even make your own, spend more on clothing, food, and lodging, guides, and the plane fares to get there, even. However, don't get him wrong, Calcutt said. All of this can be, and is in some cases, part of the fun too. The alternative, though, is to keep it simple. Hike several miles into the woods to your favorite lake, and sometimes this journey is the destination too. There's nothing that comes even close to replacing the absolute thrill of the moment when that big, hungry rainbow trout bursts through the surface on that tranquil eddy to your drifting a dry fly on. A lure perhaps you've made yourself. It's akin to hiking for a few hours and finding a good spot for playing radio, sitting down on a log to call CQ with that tiny homemade CW rig, after struggling to get your antenna wire as high as possible in that dead tree that leans over the cliff. Suddenly, you hear your call faintly being answered through the noise, and it's another operator with good ears rewarding your effort. Or maybe even better, it's a KL-7 in rural Alaska. Wowee! What joy is that, my friend? Here's a reflection from W5ESE, Whiskey 5 Echo Sierra Echo, boiling things down to the basics. Scott McMullen, W5ESE, from Dripping Springs, Texas, recalls his 2005 field day effort was pretty modest. Hiking in and setting up the station in late June in South Texas sapped a lot of energy out of me. Looking at my log, I see that my last contact Saturday evening was at 9:46 and the first Sunday morning at 6:24. What I remember most enjoying about this outing was how it reduced the hobby to basics. No digital readouts, droning generators, laptops, or gizmos. Just a few single conversion superheads, a pair of headphones, batteries, small paddles, and a gear and a tuner. On the other hand, McMullen said, to take kind of a devil's advocate position, I think it's possible sometimes to let radio ruin a perfectly good camping trip. On my two Texas CUSO party trips after operating the weekend in a contest, I stayed in the area a few more days and did one or two more backpacking trips each time, in all cases, leaving the radio stuff back in the car. On trips where you can't stay out that long, I'll sometimes limit the roll of radio by just taking a 40-meter Rockmite, 500 milliwatts, single-frequency crystal control receiver, to keep the radio in the right proportion to everything else. And folks, also included in this article, Flying Solo, Operating Alone Together, by Richard Fisher, was an experience submitted by WB2VUO, Solo Operating Strategies, and another by KD9KC from the Backyard Garden in West Texas. We just didn't have time to put them all into this commentary today, but we thanked them for their efforts. And here's a wanted notice, your solo 2010 ARRL Field Day stories. Are you operating 2010 ARRL Field Day as a solo act? We'd like to hear about your in the field experience for an upcoming trail-friendly radio column. You can please send your stories and photographs to ki6sn@aol.com. Let's take a look now at hamfests and special events for the month of June. We'll begin in the country, Canada, Special Event Station CF3NAVY, June 4 to July 3, commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Royal Canadian Navy. 160 meters to 70 centimeters, all modes. State of North Carolina, Special Event Station NC4ZO from North Carolina Aviation Museum, annual fly-in and world bird display Asheboro, North Carolina. 1300 to 2000 Zulu, June 5, on various frequencies. State of Michigan, Special Defense Station KG8EF will be operating from the Edmund Fitzgerald Memorial at Whitefish Point Lighthouse, which is U.S. designation USA 887, and Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The operation will concur during Museum Ships Weekend, June 5 and 6. This is to be a multi operation and will be active the entire weekend. State of Wisconsin, USS Cobia, Amateur Radio Club, NB9QV of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, will be on the air from the World War II submarine USS Cobia, which is AGSS-245, participating in the annual Museum Ships Afloat Weekend, June 5th and 6th. State of Tennessee, Knoxville Ham Fest and Electronics Exposition, ARRL Tennessee State Convention, Saturday, June 12, Kerr Bella Temple, Knoxville, Tennessee. State of Utah, Special Event Station K7P, Kilo 7 Papa, operating from historic Riverbed Pony Express Station from June 12 through 14, celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Pony Express. In Virginia, Manassas Hamfest Amateur Radio Computer Electronics Show, June 13 at Prince William County Fairgrounds in Manassas, Virginia. That's on Route 234. In Michigan, Monroe Hamfest, June the 20th, sponsored by Monroe County Radio Communications Association at Monroe County Fairgrounds. And in California, N6R, November 6, Romeo, 1800 Zulu, June 25 to 1800 Zulu, June 27, commemorating the late President Ronald Reagan and Mrs. Nancy Reagan. It's at the grounds of the President Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum, Simi Valley, California. It's being sponsored and worked on by the Ventura County Amateur Radio Society, joined by Simi Settlers ARC and Ventura County ARC. So for you folks who listen to these recordings, so wherever you're getting the information from, you might find this as an incentive, if it's near to where you are, to go and see what the heck this amateur radio thing is all about if you haven't really exposed yourself to it. Hi, enjoy yourselves. Summer's around, and it comes and goes rather quickly now, doesn't it, huh? Of course, there are all kinds of contests on the air for different states, different organizations, different countries. You'd have to really sort of read more about it yourselves in some of the publications to get the best picture of it. But I will give you a couple of them. One particularly is the ARRL Field Day that we keep talking about. That's actually 1800 Zulu on the 26th of June through 2100 Zulu the 27th of June. It's all bands, all modes. Regarding points, it's sort of complicated. So is the multipliers, etc. But it's fun to do. You'll hear a lot of stations out there if you have capabilities with ham radio or, for that matter, shortwave listening. You're going to hear a lot of radio operators out there yakking away. Hi, hi. So you might find some of these different contacts that would pique your interest in ham radio. Now, going from the novice to the more sophisticated, if you're into amateur satellites, FO-29 news from Japan, and lots of other activity overhead. The author here contributing is Terry Dodds, D-O-U-D-S. Terry's call is N-8-K-I. After long elapsed periods in early November 2009 took it off the air temporarily, the Japan Amateur Radio League, JARL, switched FO-29 from continuous operation to scheduled operations, allowing the command team to monitor the state of the battery charge aboard the spacecraft and adjust operations as required. FO-29 is a small, low-Earth orbit satellite equipped with a 100 kHz-wide single-sideband CW linear transponder that operates in V-slant-U mode and a DigiTalker beacon that transmits a digital voice on FM. Since the last power-up of the analog transponder on January 27, team members have received reports worldwide indicating FO-29 has been able to maintain continuous operation. The power budget aboard the spacecraft is improving as the eclipse periods decrease. JARL places no restrictions on the use of FO-29 during scheduled operation periods, except to remind satellite ground stations to transmit with a little uplink transmitter power as possible. This allows for conservation of the onboard batteries. How about putting some more fun into the CubeSat scene? FunCube is the latest satellite project being developed by AMSAT UK members. In addition to a telemetry beacon, FunCube will carry a 435 to 145 MHz linear transponder for single sideband CW operation. It will be the first time a satellite this small has carried such a transponder. Information can be seen on the FUNCUBE site at www.funcube.org.uk/. Oscar news from the United Kingdom also. AMSAT UK publishes a colorful magazine, Oscar News, that is full of amateur satellite information. Well, we're talking about satellites and things like that that hang up in the air. Let's talk about Mars. Where are MCOMs, heroes of yesterday? Serious thoughts on Mars, past and future, on the occasion of a serious anniversary. We're talking about military affiliate radio systems of the United States Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Air Force. The author here is Bill Sexton. His amateur call is N1IN. For a global phenomenon that impacts technology, culture, and national security as the need arises, amateur radio offers American adherents relatively few heroes from its century of public service. There is the ARRL's iconic Hiram Percy Maxim, of course, yet even his career outside radio as inventor and innovator is little remembered. Emergency communicators seem especially neglected, although you can argue that is because grave emergencies are not, thank goodness, all that frequent. Still, how many of today's hams ever heard of Ralph Hollis and Forrest Dana? These unsung stalwarts brought help to shattered South Florida via high-frequency communications in Morse code after the Okeechobee hurricane in 1928, which claimed upwards of 2,000 lives in that state alone. The two amateur operators won the U.S. Army's plaudits and made national headlines for ham radio. But are 4FC and 4AGR memorialized in anybody's Hall of Fame today? On the other hand, we've all heard the name Wyndham, which is attached to what was, is, and will be the number one antenna in the world, according to the website of Buck Rogers, KA4BT. But does anybody remember First Lieutenant Orange E. Wyndham, called WAGZ, as the officer who established the U.S. Army's first joint net with amateur operators? That was in 1923, 2 years before the progenitor of today's Army, Air Force, and Navy and Marine Corps Mars branches came into being. The antenna actually arrived 6 years later. I can think of seven new names deserving consideration for the pantheon of MCOM, if there were one. They made their way to Haiti in the first days after the earthquake, helping the medical responders. Of the many contributions by many amateurs and relief organizations, these seven apparently were the first civilian members of Mars ever to deploy themselves outside the United States for civil support. That was some de-expedition, working around the clock for the medics while injured Haitians amassed outside overwhelmed field hospitals. Moreover, it was the first time the three Mars chiefs worked together developing the operational response to an emergency. This year, Mars is observing the 85th anniversary of its creation, an occasion worthy of commemoration alongside the 150th birthday of the Army Signal Corps. It was on August 7, 1925, that the U.S. Army's Chief Signal Officer, Major General Charles McIntyre, Saltzman, wrote the ARRL founder Maxim conveying a plan for the affiliation of the Signal Corps with the transmitting radio amateurs of the United States. There has been a lot of history accumulating since then. The best of it will soon be told by Major Scott Hedberg. His call is 8D7MI slant X8EN5AC. In the master's thesis, he is writing for the Army School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. A military intelligence officer who served two tours in Iraq, Hedberg was scheduled to receive his degree in military arts and science, his second master's, this spring after years' intensive study. MARS was known as the Army Amateur Radio System up until 1941, when on the day after Pearl Harbor, the government suspended ham activities for the duration. Some of you still remember that. Full operations resumed in 1948 under the new name, Military Affiliate Radio System, but with separate branches for the Army and the newly fledged U.S. Air Force. The MARS acronym, so reported Hedberg, who interviewed its creator, was derived from the Roman god of war, for whom the planet Mars is also named. The Navy, which had actively pursued a close relationship with amateur radio dating back to the First World War, established its MARS branch in 1962. As this is written, a new chapter may be shaping up for Hedberg's chronicle. The current chiefs of the three MARS branches had a conference scheduled for mid-April at the Pentagon, presumably to discuss implementation of the Defense Department's recently updated charter for MARS. This goes by the name DOD Instruction 4652.2, dated December 23, 2009. Its most noticed provision was a new name for MARS, Military Auxiliary Radio System. One subject not dealt with, combined operations. Yes, three-service interoperability remains functional to MARS doctrine, and NIMS, that's the National Incident Management System, still demands unity of command. However, the new DODI avoided prescribing any mechanism for applying either concept. It's an issue that has bedeviled MARS planning at least since Hurricane Katrina demonstrated the fearful cost of uncoordinated response. If the Pentagon Conference resolves it, that will really be a milestone. Unlike today, when MARS seems to encounter difficulty establishing its own niche in the nation's disaster plan, amateurs in the 1920s rode the lead edge of communications, research, and development. The Signal Corps eventually recognized radio's game-changing role in warfare, but found itself desperately short of operators. Corps Chieftain Saltzman had a bad luck to take over when military budgets were grievously starved. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? The article goes on for quite a bit further, folks, but that's about all the time we're going to have for this month's reading here with the Courage Antihim System. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. I've been reading from World Radio Online. World Radio is published by CQ Communications, Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Antihim System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Antihim members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Antihims may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address antiham@courage.org. Lowercase, one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, at courage.org. Our website, a very fine one indeed, updated every single day, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta, M1BLF. Thanks a lot for listening along with me again today, here on the Courage Handyham System, 73.